I would like to officially welcome you to today's internet seminar on Brownfields Area-Wide Planning. This is webinar number one in a multiple seminar series that the Office of Brownfields Land Revitalization is sponsoring over the next few weeks. My name is Jean Valance, and I work here at EPA in the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, which is part of the Superfund program, and I'll be helping to moderate today's session. I'm going to go through a couple of basic instructions and housekeeping items to give a few latecomers an extra minute or two to hop on the line, and then we'll officially begin today's presentation. As a reminder, when everybody signed up for today's session or seminar, you would have seen not only a confirmation message on your computer screen, but also received a number of emails from me that would have contained reminders, giving you the phone number, as well as giving you the URL or link where you can access today's materials. That seminar homepage had a complete description of what we'll cover today, had a link or listing of our instructors, their contact information as well as mine, and also has options for you to download or access the materials. If you haven't done so already, please be sure to either click on the seminar homepage the Go to Seminar button so you can look at the seminars through the slides through a web browser window, or follow the links at the bottom of the page that allow you to download the materials as either PowerPoint or PDF. For those of you on the phone lines, we do ask that you place your phone on mute. It sounds like everybody's done that right now, so I do appreciate that. If you haven't, though, you can use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your phone line. We will be taking questions throughout the session or your comments as they come up, so you don't have to wait until the end. You can actually at any point in time take yourself off of mute and ask a question or make a comment out loud. And in order to take yourself off of mute, you hit *6. So remember, it's *6 to mute, #6 to unmute. And I will continue to remind everybody that as we go through today's session. We also, though, don't put the call on hold. If you do, sometimes there can be background music or commercials that can be disruptive. So in the meantime, until you have a comment or question, please keep yourself on mute. Everybody should now be looking at a copy of the materials. I'm going to ask you to move past slide number one and on to slide number two. If you haven't figured it out by now, CLU and Internet Seminar is very similar to a conference call. Each individual participant will be responsible for moving through the materials on their own at verbal cues from our instructors. So if you have a hard copy, simply turn the page. If you're looking at them electronically, you can click the page up, page down, or the enter button or whatever you need to scroll to the appropriate slide. If you're looking at the slides online through a web browser window, you'll see numbered links that appear on the left-hand side. You can use those to jump to the next slide as indicated by the speaker. And again, a reminder, please place your phone on mute. You want to hit *6 to mute your phone line right now.
Right, mute. Where's your mute?
I can hear you talking about the mute button. Either use that mute button or hit *6. Thank you very much. You can also use, if you're looking at the slides online, you'll see a series of orange buttons or icons that appear along the top. The single arrow pointing to the left or right will move you forward one button. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. So you can move them in either way that you need to as you're instructed by our presenters today. The other question or other button that will be important is the icon that has a question mark on it. If you click that, what that will do is open up a new window and allow you to type up a comment or question electronically. You want to be sure pop-up blockers aren't turned on because that may limit or prohibit the window from opening up. But if you click that button, again, the question mark icon, a new window will open up and you can type up a comment or question. And then again, I will read them out loud on your behalf to the instructor. So you don't have to wait until the end. You can type up your comments or questions at any time. You can also use that very same button to report any technical difficulties that you may have. Just be sure to include a telephone number so that we can call you to help troubleshoot whatever issues you may have with today's session. And the last reminder that I have for everybody today is that this entire session is being recorded and will be archived and available for you to access at a later date. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to process and post a recording on the CLUIN website. I will be providing that to our organizers today, and then they'll also provide instructions on how you can access that archive. But you should receive an automatic notification as soon as the archive is available with instructions on how you can download it or replay for free. When we're all done with today's presentation, I'm going to point people to two very important links at the very end of the PowerPoint materials today. The first one will be our resources page where you can download today's presentation materials as well as other related links. The second link that I'll point people to is a short feedback form. We do ask you to take just a minute or two to let us know what you thought of today's session. I do read each and every single one of those comments. So it is important if you'd like to see sessions like this delivered again in the future so just fill out that feedback form. If you're also looking to get credit for participating today for CEUs or PDHs, we don't necessarily give them through CLUIN, but there's an option when you fill out the feedback form to have a confirmation message sent to you for your own records, and that may help you in gaining credit through an accrediting institution. Okay, so those are the end of my formal reminders to everybody. So I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3, which is the official start of today's presentation material. And I'm going to turn things over to Charlie Barsh, who is the Senior Advisor for Economic Development in the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. Charlie?
Well, thank you and welcome everybody to this first in a series of webinars. And before I get into this, I'd like to refer to Amy Storm, from the Brownfield office, who's really been the point person on the area-wide planning effort. And I want to ask her to make a couple of introductory comments.
Thanks, Charlie. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to say thank you very much for joining us. Charlie will be going through this in a little bit, but this webinar will give you a great overview of some tools that you can be thinking about for your community revitalization project. And the participants that we included for today's session include the representatives from the 23 area-wide planning pilots for brownfields that we just started late last year. We also have folks from the 5 brownfield pilots that were done through the HUD, DOT, and EPA Partnership for Sustainable Communities. And we also included recipients of Smart Growth Implementation Assistance for this year. And certainly we have regional staff from EPA, HUD, DOT joining us today. And so great group, probably lots of questions. Charlie's really tailored this presentation to be looking at kind of area-wide planning issues around brownfields. But all the information that he provides today we think is really relevant to all the groups joining us. And so looking forward to answering your questions going forward and seeing how this type of information proves useful in your projects as you get them underway. So thanks again, and I'm going to leave it to Charlie.
Okay.
Take it away.
Okay, if you want to go to the next slide. Oops. Already a technical challenge here.
There we go.
Oh, I guess I just want to start by saying, you know, I know a lot of people who are on the call and some I don't know. And I think just to kind of kick it off, rather than do an introduction of who I am, I think I want to talk about what I'm doing at EPA now. I was brought on board about 5 months ago to help bring an economic development focus to OSWER. And I'm really excited because really working with the area-wide pilots on strategies that will ultimately lead to project implementation is really an important part of this. You know, what I'm doing and what I hope we all can do is really reaching out to some of our different revitalization partners, you know, to other agencies within EPA, to the private sector. Some of this will play out through some of the formal partnership structures that have been established, but I think a lot of it will play out really through informal working relationships that I know are being developed at the sustainability pilot level. Some of those might be useful, and some other informal relationships. And I think the whole goal of all this partnership activity is really helping make project implementation links to help make the fit. I think, you know, one of the things that I've been asked to do is figure out, you know, what kind of economic development focus can we really have here? And I think it's important, and we'll talk about some of the market climate issues in a minute, but really when you're looking at reuse, when you're looking at infill, you know, environmental concerns are a real key piece of the beginning of this. And as such, EPA really does play a critical initial component in the redevelopment continuum, at least at the federal level. So we can go to the next slide. I just want to take a second to talk. This is the first in a series of webinars focusing on some of the different federal partners. And so what we want to do in this one is to just briefly recap some of the area-wide planning concepts and, you know, give a quick update. And also briefly look at the current real estate climate because, you know, it is going to have an impact on what you can do, you know, at the local level with respect to putting together your area-wide planning redevelopment strategies. The current climate really does tell us why tools and partnerships are needed. I want to use this as an opportunity to introduce you to some of the federal family partners, you know, like what's out there, give you some sense of what they can do. And I'm going to give you some examples along the way. And as Gene said, this is going to be archived soon. So some of the examples I may go through kind of quickly just to kind of keep moving. And again, we're going to have questions along the way. If I don't hear you, if I get on a roll and I miss you, please just speak up and we'll get back to the point where we need to ask and answer your question. So if we can move on to the next slide, I just want to mention that our webinar series objectives, I mean, today is to provide an overview of some of the federal program resources for area-wide planning grantees to consider. It's our real goal is to have you think about, give you some sense as to what's out there, what these programs can do, how they can help you down the line when you're thinking about project implementation, because knowing what's available may help to inform some of your initial thinking and strategy efforts. I mean, it really may, you know, as you have several options to consider, it may help you kind of focus in on which ones may be more viable or more useful. For the series as a whole, which we'll give you some dates at the end, it's going to play out over the next couple of months. What we want to then do is really give you an in-depth agency-specific information, you know, with people from the agencies and with some, you know, some community-based examples that'll help show you how you can use some of this resource information to really shape optimum implementation strategies, you know, help you figure out what can you best carry out. And that'll include some ideas on how to open the door to some of the agency resources, how to kind of make that first contact, how to connect some of the basic information and criteria, how to take the first steps, you know, how to look at what's next, and really, I think most importantly, kind of identify what might be some common concerns and solutions to those as you're dealing with other agencies and how to navigate the programs. Because it's certainly OBLR's goal, and it's certainly my goal, that when this is all said and done, you know, we'd really like to make sure that as you're pulling together these area-wide plans, that the real goal is that there's going to be life after this process, that we're going to see some real projects done. So what we're trying to do is really give you information to kind of inform that process, you know, as you're beginning it. And if you want to go to the next one, just to briefly recap the context and goals of area-wide planning, you know, and Amy has noted these on a number of grantee calls already. I mean, really the whole purpose of the area-wide planning is to really look at it as a new approach to integrate site cleanup and reuse into a more coordinated community development strategy. And I think the overall pilot grantee objectives along this line are to identify potential brownfield site reuses and also create area-wide strategies that are going to ensure successful site assessment and cleanup and reuse. So figuring out how to use specific brownfield areas as a real key to a larger area revitalization effort. And as part of this, these strategies will help us figure out how to facilitate reuse of existing infrastructure and define the investments that are needed to accommodate future site uses. And I think a real key piece of this, which really fits into the goal of these webinars, is that the planning process will really set the stage for project implementation, you know, new uses that are consistent with the area-wide plan. And if you want to just move on to the next one, just a quick status update. The projects are underway. How's that for a nice concise status report? But I think what's on the radar screen in the context of that process, you know, Amy in the Brownfield office and I are certainly working to try to figure out ways to identify and leverage additional investment that can help you implement the plans you're going to develop. And as part of that, we want to figure out the best ways of linking grantees to some of the information resources and the context that can help you make the decisions that you need to make that'll lead to some projects when this is all said and done. And that may involve prioritization, may involve sorting out different options. I think really the next step in this process here is highlighting some of the viable federal program options that you all can consider as you begin to think about your implementation planning. Again, that's really the goal of going through this agency by agency. And now, just the next slide to move into our, you know, to start to move into our main discussion. When you begin thinking about trying to attract investment to your target planning efforts and as you're trying to promote reuse projects, you know, what exactly do you need to know about the current real estate market issues and what's happening out there that may influence financing decisions, that may influence what you decide to pursue in your area-wide planning effort? Well, the conditions continue to evolve, but I think a quick recap based on research that I've recently done points to a number of things, as you can see on this slide. You know, certainly from the private financing approach, we're seeing tighter underwriting. You know, banks are just not giving out as much money on project percentage-wise as they used to. I mean, there is a lower loan-to-value ratio. They're concerned about lower collateral values. And we're seeing a greater bank aversity to risk. So you need to remember that as you start planning projects and what you want to do. Certainly one of the things out there is capital is going to be tight over the near term. We're seeing a lot of refinancings are going to have to take place, a lot of projects that were financed sort of in the boom times in the, 2007, 2008. Many of those were done as short-term financing. They're going to have to be refinanced. Some of the experts I've talked to have suggested that as much as $1 trillion is going to be needed by 2013 for these refinancings. So what that means is there's going to be pressure on capital availability for new efforts. We're also seeing the banking industry continue to have signs of distress. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation puts together a problem list pretty frequently. There's a lot of banks on it now. We've seen a lot of bank failures in the last couple of years. I mean, 156 banks failed in 2010, and already in the first couple of months of this year, 23 have failed. And a lot of those banks that have gone under have been smaller regional and community banks, which can be a key source of capital for small projects, and they can be a key source of capital for small town efforts. So, again, something to keep in mind. One of the things that's affecting real estate everywhere, including Brownfield, is that more and more properties are now upside down. Their values have dropped, but at the same time, from a Brownfield perspective, the cleanup costs aren't dropping and the site preparation costs aren't dropping. So you've got less to work with going back with that loan-to-value ratio. If I can get to the next slide, from a redevelopment and resource side, we're seeing, revenues are declining. Projects aren't making as much money. Sort of investors aren't making as much money. And what all this means is that some of the traditional tools of more sophisticated deal makers like tax increment finance or tax abatements or tax credit syndication, well, there's less revenue to TIF and there's less income to abate, so these tools need to be looked at very carefully as part of a brownfield financing strategy. And I think one of the things, too, we're seeing is that there's just a decline in the types of traditional infill and reuse that have really been frequently associated with brownfield reuse in the past. I mean, the retail chains aren't expanding as much. I don't think we're quite seeing a Starbucks on every corner anymore. Yep. And so we're seeing a lot of these kinds of uses. There's less demand for office space. So we have to think very creatively about what we're going to put in these project sites. And this combined with the fact that, state and local budget deficits, we all are working in cities, we all are working with cities that are really pressed for cash. And there's spending pressures, they're limiting the investment that can be made in a whole range of, smart growth and sustainable type reuse projects. I mean, you can see the figures on the slide, a lot of deficits at the state level. A lot of cities are reporting difficulty in meeting, their basic service needs. So I think the bottom line for us as we're thinking about reuse is that we're not likely to find a hidden pile of cash someplace that's just laying around waiting to be plugged into our area-wide strategy. So we need to think, with those facts in mind, too. But if you go to the next slide, I mean, those of you who know me know that I am a rose-colored glasses-type person, and I think the long-term forecast for redevelopment redevelopment is going to make sense again, and I think one of the things that we're seeing is that there's opportunities, coming up for linking green and brown together in a revitalization strategy. Some of the economists that I've talked to are looking for the real estate recovery to start in, later this year and certainly into the middle of next year, and I think from an area-wide planning pilot time frame, this is a good time frame. I think what's even more important is a lot of those same economists are seeing that infill first may be a prime local strategy as the development market starts to come back. And this is a trend that can dovetail really nicely with a brownfield area-wide approach. What we're seeing is that this downtime is giving us a really good opportunity to plan for reuse, to prepare properties, to position properties. Again, these are really key pieces of a good area-wide implementation strategy. And even now, we're seeing growing demand for sustainable end uses. we're seeing a lot more interest in green buildings, a lot more interest in green infrastructure, all the kinds of things that ultimately help reduce operations and maintenance costs. This also fits well with a smart growth and a redevelopment strategy. And what I'm also, you know, hearing, talking to a lot of private sector developers and those who have been active in brownfields in the past, would like to be active in the future, is increasingly they're saying that the public sector incentives are poised to play an even greater role in this whole process as a catalyst, as a gap funder, as sort of the foundation for the partnerships that are going to be needed to make these site reuses successfully happen. What that means for us is that it's a great opportunity to think about, you know, some of the traditional programs from the various agencies and how they can be adapted to these new situations, how they can take advantage of interest in green and infill. There's clearly new opportunities to be tapped, and we're going to talk about these as the webinar series unfolds over the next couple of months, you know, through the Department of Transportation, through the USDA Rural Development Administration, just to give you a couple of examples, as well as some of the traditional redevelopment agencies. And this all means that that alternative packaging strategies are going to be even more important. So I wanted to provide that context as we move into a discussion of tools. But if we go into the next slide, you know, what you're going to face when you're thinking about implementation, when you're planning about what you want to reuse some of these sites for, this is really sort of the red box of impact. There's a number of brownfield-specific financing challenges that you're likely to face as you work on developing these reuse strategies. And this is just sort of my take on a vastly simplified sort of look at the redevelopment process, but in the red box are the things that have a brownfield impact that you're going to have to figure out how to deal with and figure out how to pay for as you move forward with projects. I mean, there may be stigma issues depending on the use you want to use. And no matter what you're going to do, you're going to have to, you know, come up with resources to pay for site assessment. There's going to be, again, in the context of this, stricter lender and investor underwriting. You may have to do additional, testing. You may have to do additional sort of corroboration or justification for the rate of return. Clearly, you're going to have to prepare a cleanup plan. You're going to likely have to take it through some of the, you know, the state and local voluntary cleanup programs. You have to do the cleanup. So this is what you're going to have to do between sort of figuring out what you want to do with the site at the top and actually getting it done at the bottom. And so, again, just some activities you need to focus on as you're thinking about moving forward. So this gets into the real meat of what I want to do today. So as you're working to meet those red box impacts and figure out how to put these resources together, you know, as you're working to figure out the planning strategies that can make your sites work, it's important to remember that there's a lot of tools out there and that they can be fit together and leveraged in various ways to promote brownfield reuse. Probably the major lesson of this whole overview is that while everybody likes to get grants, and, you know, it's obviously you get the direct resources, and who wouldn't want to get a grant? There's also a number of things out there that these tools can do that can be almost as good as getting the money. I mean, these tools can help in some cases, you know, loan guarantees can help reduce the lender's risk, and there may be resources available that can help you write down interest rates or help do some of that additional due diligence that's going to be needed to attract private money. Things like repayment grace periods or tax abatements or even technical assistance help can improve the borrower's financial situation so that they can better and more creatively deploy their own resources. And one of the things that's been very interesting in the last couple of years, and what I think will become even more important now, as we all think about how to integrate, you know, some of these new innovative cleanup technologies or institutional control strategies into the reuse, there are institutions and entities out there, you know, university centers, technical resource centers, and institutions like that can really be your partner in going to the lender or investor and corroborating that this is going to work. You know, again, you can really reduce some of the risk with a neutral partner that can say, this technology can work, this cap will work, and you can really provide some of that comfort that may be needed to pry loose some of the private money you're going to need. So I think the bottom line on the tools is that partnerships really go beyond winning the grant. There's a lot of ways in which that these resources can be fit together, you know, in conjunction with each other to really help you move towards an implementation. And if we go to the next slide, really a big part of this is looking very creatively and very broadly at really what I call the federal partners laundry list. Every program on that slide has been used some way or the other over the last few years by some entity or another to do some sort of a brownfield project or the other, some piece of it along the way. It really is all about making the fit, you know, between their criteria, you know, their sort of program requirements and your brownfield needs. And from this list, if you go to the next slide, what I want to do is just focus on, you know, some of the federal programs that are most commonly used. And I just want to mention at this point that as you're out there, you know, working, you know, in your pilot areas, if you have any questions or issues come up about any of not only the programs on the current slide, but on the big laundry list slide, you know, please get them to Rachel or Amy or I, and we'll see what we can do to help you kind of run interference and make the links, because there's some really important tools out there. But just to focus on this list here, I'm going to look at this. You can see, you know, HUD, EDA, USDA, transportation, EPA. I'm going to look at these in a bit more detail. And remember, we're going to go, you know, we're going to offer webinars, you know, in the next couple of months on these specific programs. So if we want to just move on here, we're going to start off by focusing on the next slide on HUD's Community Development Block Grant Program. The HUD block grants are distributed a couple of ways depending on the local population. HUD provides direct formula-based CDBG grants to entitlement jurisdictions. That formula includes factors such as age of housing and a range of other distress factors. But if you're a city of over 50,000 or an urban county of over 200,000, you get an automatic annual grant from HUD. If you're a smaller community, what happens is your state will get a formula-based grant. Generally, it goes to the State Department of Development. And then those state grants, the state decides how it is going to distribute its funds to communities of less than 50,000 people. So if we want to go on to the next slide, really what...
Charlie?
Yeah.
This is Amy at the Redevelopment Agency in Fresno. I don't know if Fresno is the only community that faces this problem, but the bulk, in fact, all of our CDBG funds are used for by the city internally. And so we don't, you know, we wouldn't be eligible to receive them anyway, but as it stands, nobody can receive CDBG funds. Are we the only ones?
It's certainly my impression. We're going to have HUD on in a few weeks on a webinar, but it's my impression that that's highly unusual.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
Because again, and we'll get to this in a couple minutes, but, I mean, how the funds are actually spent on the ground is a local decision, but most communities provide some of those CDBG funds to nonprofits and community development corporations and others to carry out projects that meet HUD's criteria. And you can actually see it on the current slide we're on now. I mean, HUD has three broad objectives that the CDBG funds need to meet. They need to benefit low and moderate income persons. They need to be used to prevent or eliminate slums and blight. And they can be used to meet an urgent community need, although that very rarely happens. I mean, that would be like, you know, if you had like a flood, a blizzard, a building collapse, something like that. I mean, something that just really comes up. But again, you know, most communities, you know, obviously use some of those resources themselves, but they also, you know, delegate some of those resources to, you know, service delivery or project delivery, you know, organizations and institutions within the city. So, okay. That is unusual. And just to get a sense of the area-wide potential, I mean, it can be key because block grant funding is, you know, within those criteria, those HUD objectives is very flexible. And, you know, in practice, it has been used to help pay for all phases of brownfield redevelopment or project implementation. And, in fact, in any recent year, if you look at the numbers, more CDBG money has gone into brownfield projects nationally than EPA money. So that's just to give you some sense of the magnitude. And if we want to move on to the next slide.
That would be slide 18.
Slide 18, I'm sorry.
Just to catch everyone up.
Yeah. And if people get lost, please just skip Haller in. I kind of, like I said, I get on a roll and I forget some of the details. So, but you know, slide 18, you know, just looking at, you know, some of the block grant eligible activities, there's a number of these that do have links to brownfield redevelopment needs. I mean, you can use CDBG, you know, for demolition or removal, for structural rehabilitation, for basic planning. I think where it gets really very useful as a key piece of a revitalization strategy, and where it could be useful, you know, in many of the area-wide planning pilots, things like construction or reconstruction of infrastructure, you know, things like, you know, public facilities, recreational facilities. I mean, HUD's rules allow CDBG to be used to help deal with contamination as part of the project. And I think what's also important, again, in some cases, is there is a mechanism known as the CDBG float, whereby CDBG funds can be lent to private companies in some circumstances. It's typically small amounts of money, and these have to be done for basically business development, business creation projects that generate jobs. And there is a process to this, but it can be done. And I think for the state and small cities program, it's important to remember that each state sets its own project funding priorities, and it defines its own program requirements. So as long as the state's distribution priorities fit one of those three broad HUD objectives, it can do them. Your real key is working with your state department of development to make sure that what you want to do fits within those state criteria. And I'm a great believer in just pictures and examples. So if we want to go to slide 19, I'm just going to run through a couple of examples over the next few slides very briefly, just to show how the block grant can be used. This is the first example from Youngstown, Ohio, a good example of a manufacturing project. The plant built in a distressed area, and in this case, the reason this worked is it was a distressed area, and the plant operator pledged to consider community residents in their first hire agreement. Basically, what happened is CDBG was used to pay for the first year of the loan cost so that the Expo Corporation didn't have to immediately start paying off its note. It could use its resources to deal with brownfield and training and other needs. And so the block grant covered that first year of the loan. And those of you from cities out there are wondering what's going to happen. Well, what they're going to do is they basically added a year onto the loan term so that very last year of payoff will go back to the city to cover the CDBG. And I think our lesson here in an area-wide planning context is it really can give developers flexibility in applying their own resources to meet brownfield needs so that projects can go forward. Our next example is the Jack Evans Police Station in Dallas. This was sort of a brownfield twofer, if you will. It was a former gas station and dry cleaner site, all in one. And here the CDBG was used for basic site preparation, which included some of the cleanup and included some of the demolition. And I think here the lesson is if you have a site like this, you know, especially in an area-wide context, I mean, this is actually a classic example of an area-wide reuse because the city of Dallas had identified this area as a focal area for revitalization. A real key concern was sort of crime and public safety in that area, so the police station was put in to help deal with that piece of it to make the surrounding area more attractive for investment. Which is really our key area-wide lesson. And if we want to go on to the next slide, this would be number 21. This is a small city example. Baldwinville, New York used some CDBG money to help do some of the site design and site preparation for what is now known as the Paper Mill Island Park. I think what's interesting about this one is at the time they got the money, the state of New York state priorities were infrastructure and recreational space. So they were not brownfield priorities per se, but they were priorities that clearly Baldwinville was able to kind of shape and apply in a brownfield context. So I think here our lesson is really that you can really think creatively about end use and kind of work back and meet your brownfield need. Now, if we went to the next slide, one of the things I want to try to do is, I mean, obviously, you know, if these programs were also easily available, of course, we heard from Fresno that they're not, but if they were also easily available, why wouldn't everybody be using them? Well, there are some reality checks and some points to consider. We want to try to raise those now so that you may use these as even the point of departure to ask our agency reps some questions when we have webinars, you know, the next couple of months. The first one is that, you know, projects are locally determined, so, you know, local leadership really needs to be a critical ally in how you map out your projects. There's also a lot of local competition for this funding. A number of communities that do provide resources to, you know, CDCs and others, well, a lot of those recipients have been recipients for a long time, and it can be difficult to get a new initiative into the process. And also the CDBG funds are facing a lot of budget pressure right now. And the last point out there I want to mention is that you know, while HUD has three objectives, the low and moderate income benefit is its key one. In fact, HUD's rules require that, except in really extenuating circumstances, at least 70% of all CDBG funds have to be used to benefit low and moderate income people. Although at the same time, I'm going to say, given the nature of just about all the pilots, I mean, I think they were all focused on distressed areas, I think there's a really a good chance that most of the area-wide planning areas could meet the low mod criteria pretty easily. So I just wanted to get those reality checks out there.
I had a comment that came in online from Maine, and this is just that there were two general comments that were made in relation to federal funding. And in this first comment mentioned that the proposed federal budget includes a 62% reduction in funding. So for the state of Maine, that reduces the amount of funds from $14 million to less than $6
million. Okay. And I guess on that one, I would only say that the budget has not been finalized. I mean, there's almost the number of the day as we're going through these next couple of weeks. I mean, I think the program will sustain cuts. And that's just my personal opinion. I guess I should say that I have to get used to doing that because I'm so new here at EPA. But the final numbers aren't in, but that's really part of the budget, the pressures that I was referring to. I mean, I think the area-wide planning pilots are in an excellent position given their nature and what they want to do and the benefits that will come from them. They're going to be in an excellent position to make their case for funding, but it's going to be challenging because the funding will be tight. And there, you said there was a second comment?
Yeah, and this may have been mentioned earlier, but someone else mentioned that HUD dropped BEDI in fiscal year 11 appropriations.
Right, and actually that's which is why we didn't put that in here. I mean, that was a tiny program. Its last appropriation was $20 million, and that included carryover, and that was a national figure, and that funding was pretty, in practice, pretty confined to larger cities and big projects, just the way it worked out. But we didn't include that because that's gone. And actually, another tool which we didn't include in today either, and we can ask HUD about this, is their Section 108 Loan Guarantee Program, which, you know, for 30 years has been used to really do a lot of basic infrastructure development, has been really critical in a lot of larger scale manufacturing and office development. That too has also been proposed for a reconfiguration and a cutback. So, you know, that'll be something. Hopefully, you know, when we have HUD on in a few weeks, the dust will have settled on some of these numbers and some of these policy sort of directions. Hey,
this is Charlie. This is Vaham from CV in Huntington Park. Could you explain the last bullet on the slide 22 a little more about the low mod benefit?
Sure. Basically, the one of the basic criteria for using HUD's Community Development Block Grant funding is that 70% of the resources need to benefit low and moderate income people, and HUD defines those, if I can remember this right, as people whose income is 80% of the area median, or mean, area mean, the area average. I'll use the term that I understand, the area average. So it has to help people who are lower income. And it can do that in a number of ways. It can actually, you know, build facilities that will help them. So, for example, you could, you know, build a healthcare facility, which actually might be a good use of a brownfield site. It can support business or commercial activities that will employ people that are low and moderate income people, or it can do housing, or it can just do direct services for them. But it has to benefit them in some way, 70% of the resources. And in practice, most communities, because that's such a, that is like the one hard and fast rule. I mean, most communities actually strive to do more than that just to make sure that it all, that they can be in compliance. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Huh? Okay, we're going to shift that to the next agency, and this is the Economic Development Administration, or EDA. It's part of the Department of Commerce, and they offer a number of programs, but three of them in particular are especially well-suited to brownfield-type activities. They're public works grants, finance industrial site redevelopment or building reuse and infrastructure preparation. You know, in practice this means, well, I'll get to that in a second, what that in practice means. The economic dislocation program, this is a program that's been designed to help areas that have faced what EDA terms either a long-term economic dislocation or a sudden severe economic dislocation. And what that jargon means in practice is, you know, areas that may have suffered a plant closing or suffered just a long-term decline in their basic economic base. I mean, in practice, a lot of those resources go to areas that have seen their manufacturing base, you know, just ebb, or they've seen a significant plant closure. What it does is it helps do a number of things, but the key piece of that is EDA can give money to communities to capitalize revolving loan funds that will help them do a number of new things like attract business. And the third thing is rural planning. EDA provides planning resources through economic development districts, and those planning resources are intended to help smaller towns and rural areas figure out really what their next steps are in terms of economic and community development. And clearly, you know, if you're thinking about an economic development outcome for your area-wide project, the potential there is significant because the EDA resources can help finance business-based job-promoting activities and also support additional planning that you might need. So if we go on to the next slide, number 24, you know, EDA's eligible activities that do have connections to economic or community development include things like revitalizing or upgrading or expanding infrastructure that's needed to retain or attract jobs. In practice, EDA has done a number of things, you know, like supporting development of small business incubators in abandoned buildings, you know, modernizing industrial parks, things like this. It can also attract new business and industry to targeted areas, which may be important in some of the area-wide contexts. It can do things like site preparation, including demolition or removal. It can do some cleanup in the context of a site. It can do things like, you know, construction or rehabilitation of public and private facilities. So it can do a number of things that have important brownfield context. I just want to give you a couple of examples. If you look at the next two slides, the first one is a very interesting one in Plainview, Arkansas. This is a former Superfund site, actually. It was a former lumber pressure treating facility. And it was cleaned and redeveloped as a specialty steel plant. And what was interesting about this in practice, it was a very common sense strategy for dealing with a pretty problematic site. Plainview, Arkansas also has the distinction of being surrounded on a couple of sides by national forests. So its economic redevelopment really needed to be infill because they didn't have a lot of opportunities to expand outside. And in this case, it was the EDA money supported site preparation and construction and infrastructure. And today, in the small town, 25 new jobs and some significant tax revenues. And I think our area-wide planning lesson here is that for some types of projects like this, you can really use EDA infrastructure resources very broadly to support a range of site preparation needs that are required to put it back in place. And if you look at the next slide, this is the Bates Mill in Lewiston, Maine. EDA here, this project has been around for a while, but it's an interesting one in the context of sort of a sequential redevelopment. It was an old textile mill. It's been converted into a small business incubator. And the EDA, well, it wasn't a huge amount of the money. It was about $1 million of public works money went into this. It was really critical upfront money that was needed to get this project kicked off. And I think one of the things that I like about this example is, you know, you talk about what's needed, and obviously in this tight financial time, I mean, you know, tax abatements are being considered by local governments, I think, much more rigorously because of the revenue impact. Well, this is a great example. Even with the original tax abatements in place, this project is generating, you know, close to four times the tax revenues it did at the time it shut down. So again, and I think our area-wide lesson here is that, you know, that as you're thinking about what might work, it's just possible to think about a staged or phased project that can take advantage of a reemerging market. And it's really a way of more realistically integrating some of the public resources that are needed to make this one work. And if we go to the next slide, like the HUD CDBG, there's a number of points here to consider, too, the reality check. EDA has very limited funding, and it has significant competition for its resources. On the plus side of this, I mean, the applications are accepted on a rolling basis, so there's no firm deadline. I mean, they're really guided by when their money is gone. And also, you work very closely with your regional office level and a number of the regional offices. They've got, I think, six regions, and we can get you those contacts if you're interested in pursuing that. But the regional office is really a key player in this, and a number of the regional offices are really attuned to what brownfields means and how it works in community revitalization. Now, what may be a limiting factor as you're thinking about what you want to do in your area-wide effort is EDA projects are driven by, I mean, they're really evaluated on their job-generating potential. So if your project is not going to generate a lot of jobs, this may not work for you. And I think their current rule of thumb is you've got to generate at least one job for each $50,000 in help. Also, their key eligibility criteria, what really, you know, really brings your project to the top of the competition is your unemployment rate. So if you're in an area that is not particularly suffering relative to the national unemployment average, that may work against you. And conversely, if you're in an area that has significant unemployment, this may work for you. While there's no statutory split urban-rural with EDA, they tend to focus more on smaller towns and rural areas. And typically the last few years, half or more of their resources have gone to smaller towns of less than 50,000 people. I think what's really also important is that it's really pretty easy to integrate brownfield redevelopment activities into, you know, EDA planning. You know, EDA provides resources to fund comprehensive economic development strategies, and this can be a nice fit. So are there any questions on EDA before I move on?
This is a reminder, if you're on the phone lines, you can hit #6, take yourself off of mute, and ask your question directly.
Or I'd be happy to take them from you, Jean.
And I do have two comments that came in regarding EDA. The first one was just from a community that mentioned that they have a $2.5 million grant pending with EDA, and part of the project is in a contaminated 11-acre site that is unfortunately not part of the grant because of land acquisition issues, but it's slated for build-out next year. If they receive an assessment grant, then the parcel will be part of it. And they were suggesting that grantees should definitely consider an EDA construction loan. They found five manufacturers in a horribly blighted industrial area that were all expanding, and EDA is the last vestige of infrastructure grants. So their area is missing sewer, flood control, paved streets, curbs, and gutters. So in return for hundreds of jobs and millions of on-site improvement, they're investing about $5 million into the area. So they really just thought that EDA was a great resource for reuse and leveraging private development. They also did want to mention that EDA changed its process, so they suggested that you go to EDA.gov to review the new process.
And that's actually a good point, and we're going to have EDA on in, I forget, well, we'll give you the date at the end, sometime within the next month or so to talk about that. And that's actually a really good point that they are streamlining that or changing that process. And it sounds like that the community that commented probably has a economic dislocation grant from EDA. It's one of the most flexible grants that's out there, so I'm really glad that they commented with what they're doing, because it can really be an excellent source of flexible money to deal with pretty much anything you need to deal with on a site reuse.
What's the name of that grant again?
Their economic dislocation. I'm guessing that's what it is, the way that the comment came through.
And they also mentioned that EDA accepts on a quarterly basis.
EDA, Well, EDA headquarters will take them on a rolling basis. I mean, it may be that the regional office has its own system in place. But the real issue, of course, is when the money is gone, it's gone. I mean, it's, you know, like any kind of rolling process, it's better to get your dibs in sooner rather than later when, you know, and I would urge people, you know, on this call, if you're thinking about this, I mean, once the appropriations are finalized for 11, I mean, that'll be the time to really hit up your EDA offices and really think about what might be done, because there'll be fresh money out there.
Okay. Any comments or questions on the phones?
Just a question. This is I'm from CB Huntington Park. The EDA, is this mostly for municipalities, right? Or
who qualifies? It's basically, you know, public and quasi-public entities. I mean, a private company has to work through a recipient to get the resources in most cases. And it depends on the program. Like the rural planning pretty much functions through quasi-public or nonprofit. The actual bricks and mortar has to be done through a sort of a unit of local government, which can be like a redevelopment authority, the way EDA defines it, but definitely not a private business.
Okay. Thank you.
Actually, if I could just add one more thing to that, in some ways, you know, you should think about it the way you think about it with some of the brownfield cleanup resources. I mean, you know, it's really the partnership. I mean, while we don't fund private companies directly, clearly, you know, our recipients and our communities work very closely with, you know, end users and end reusers, you know, to kind of get those resources where they need to go. So in some ways, it's that same kind of sort of mindset approach. Okay. All right. We're going to move on to slide 28, which is USDA, the Rural Development Program. You know, I mean, those of us here in the room, you know, Amy and Rachel and the Office of Sustainable Communities and others have really been reaching out a lot to USDA recently because, you know, their resources, as we have learned, are very flexible and very applicable to brownfield situations as long as if you're in a small community. If you look at the slide up there, I mean, the rural development, there's really four key programs that can really play an important role in a brownfields context. The community facility loans and grants, and this is basically for public facilities, you know, fire stations, health clinics, things like this, you know, parks and open space. And the business and industry loans can go to public or private organizations for activities, you know, that enhance the business development climate in a rural area. There's a program called an intermediary relending program. Basically, USDA provides money to entities like local governments who then can just relend it to private companies in order to finance business facilities. And then the rural development grants, the RBEGs and the RBOGs, small programs, but they've been set up to help provide operating capital and to finance emerging business and industry in rural areas. Some very important programs. If we go on to the next slide, just to kind of get a handle on what these things can do, just again to mention that the rural development programs at USDA have great flexibility. There are a lot of opportunities for you, you know, in the communities that qualify, you know, to make the fit between what they've got and what you need for your brownfields. And in fact, like I mentioned, we're working on, I think, developing this relationship with USDA here at EPA. And we're trying to reach out and kind of, you know, help them understand how their programs can play such an important part. And in terms of the kinds of activities that USDA can fund, I mean, they're actually very similar to CDBG. You can use these resources, depending on the program, for planning, you know, for site clearance or preparation, including demolition, you know, for structural rehabilitation or improvement, for construction of real estate improvements, which, again, is an important thing. You know, these are the streets, the sidewalks, you know, the other amenities that really make the site attractive for reuse. And I think the area-wide potential, I mean, a lot of these USDA programs can be used to meet brownfield cleanup and redevelopment needs, are really complementary activities to the reuse effort. I mean, there's just a lot of potential here. I want to give you a couple of examples of how this has, how brownfield type needs have been met through USDA. If we can just go to slide 30, the next one. This is a housing development in Seaford, Delaware. It was an abandoned sewing machine factory. This was developed by a nonprofit, and it was the USDA Rural Development Loan that played a key partnership role in getting this project done. What was actually very interesting about this in terms of an area-wide planning lesson, well, it shows that, you know, even in small towns, housing can be a real viable rural development end use, and it can also be done in a way that meets infill and reuse objectives. And if we go to the next slide, one of my favorite all-time examples of rural development in action, the Potosi Brewery in Potosi, Wisconsin. This is a town of 700 people. Before the brewery was abandoned, I mean, this is the economic driver for Potosi, Wisconsin. And this was done, I mean, a big partnership here. I mean, EPA provided, you know, some support. I mean, the state of Wisconsin provided some site assessment support. But the real driver was the $3.3 million USDA Rural Development Business and Industry Guaranteed Loan. This was the only reason the additional private funding came into play here, because of the guarantee that USDA provided. This project has transformed Potosi's Main Street. I mean, if you can see, I don't know how clearly you can see where you're at, but those top couple of pictures, this is the heart of downtown Potosi prior to the project underway. Today, you know, it's like I said, it's totally brought this town back. I mean, I also want to mention one of the things that was very helpful here is the National Trust for Historic Preservation has a program called its Main Street Program, which provides technical assistance to primarily smaller communities, although they don't have to be this tiny, in figuring out how to bring back Main Streets and towns. It can be a key tool if it's really nicely, you know, in a smart growth context and an infill context, and they provided technical assistance here to Potosi. And I think the bottom line on this is that it was just a great success. I mean, since this opened in June of 2008, there have been more than 50,000 visitors to this town of 700 people, created a number of new jobs and ancillary activity. I mean, it really shows how a single project on a brownfield can be a driver for larger community effort, not the least of which to mention in Potosi. I mean, you know, 50 new jobs and 4 new beers, you know, not bad for a town of 700 people. And I think our area-wide lesson here is that cleanup really can be integrated as part of a downtown area revitalization strategy leading to, you know, additional commercial and job-generating development. So if we go to the next slide, I mean, you know, like all the agencies and programs, I mean, there are some points you need to consider and some reality check. The first one is that for USDA, their applications are made to state USDA offices on a rolling basis. What's really important to understand about USDA rural development, it's a federal program, it's federal money. Each state runs its own show. Each state office has significant influence in the funding decisions. You know, the states, you know, get formal or informal allocations from headquarters as to how much money they can put into these individual programs, and they have a tremendous amount of latitude in deciding where that funding goes within the state. So if you're in a small community, and I guess to get to this next point too, the population is the key determining factor. Typically, the smaller the community, the more competitive it is. Different of the programs have different population thresholds. Some of the programs operate at populations as little as, am I remember this right, 10,000 people. So if you're over 10,000, it can be more challenging. Others of them, you can go up to 50,000 as long as you're not in a metro area. But like I said, the state offices have a lot of influence in how this works, and so it's really important if you're in a community that qualifies for some of this to really reach out to your state office director and really explain to them, you know, what you want to do and how what you want to do is a rural development project and part of a rural development strategy. Private entities are eligible for the business and industry assistance, which is usually given as a loan guarantee. Nonprofits are eligible for all rural development assistance. Again, very flexible. And really, you can, I mean, these programs can support pretty much the full range of business, commercial, industrial, and what USDA terms essential community facility projects. And those would be, you know, hospitals, community centers, things like that. Huge amount of flexibility in this program. Tremendous brownfield potential. We want to move on to the next one. I want to...
Sorry, what the...
Oh, I'm sorry. Are there any questions on USDA?
Yeah, it sounds like there's one question on the phone line. Go ahead.
Yeah, on slide 31, you said that, I didn't catch the name. You said there was a National Trust for...
It's a National Trust for Historic Preservation. If you go on their website, look for their National Main Street Technical Assistance Program. They have a number of technical assistance resources that are available, you know, to communities who are focusing on Main Street revitalization efforts. And again, it doesn't focus on brownfields at all, but it's the kind of thing that if your Main Street revitalization happens to include a number of these kinds of buildings and facilities, it could be a good tool to kind of figure out how to start putting together a broader reuse effort for your Main Street.
This is not just for rural areas, is it? Or
okay. I'm sorry?
This is not just for rural areas, right? Is it for rural
and
urban areas?
The Main Street program covers is not just for rural areas. It can be a harder fit with a big city. On the other hand, I think that their Main Street program in larger cities can focus on sort of a neighborhood Main Street. It doesn't have to be the Main Street. It doesn't have to be State Street in Chicago necessarily. It can be a neighborhood Main Street. And there's not a lot of resources there, but they can really be very helpful in pointing you towards what you might put together.
There was also a question that came in online from the city of Atlanta in Atlanta, Georgia. They wanted to know if USDA could help funding a community garden program. They mentioned that in our AWP project area, the neighborhood has suggested turning in some of the vacant lots that may be potential brownfields into community gardens.
There may be someone else in the room who would answer this a little better than me, but basically when you say fund it, if it's to actually kind of help them build the gardens and put the dirt in place and plant the stuff, no. But what USDA can do is provide technical assistance on, you know, strategies and approaches for doing that. That's actually something we're trying to explore with USDA right now to figure out, a more productive partnership with them to bring those resources to bear in larger cities. But right now, if it's to actually do construct the gardens, it doesn't work.
Okay, I also just want to do a quick time check for you, Charlie, that we're on slide, I think, number 33, and we've got about 30 minutes left.
Okay, well, I will pick up the pace. I should mention for people, too, that I put a lot of information in here on tax incentives, which we can go through quickly. My goal today was to really get through these actual programs that we're getting through now, and we've got, just a couple more to get through, and then we'll see how we get on the tax stuff. The tax stuff is more for a flavor. But actually, shifting now to slide 33, which is the transportation programs, the Department of Transportation has a number of highway and transit programs, which I think we're very excited about figuring out how to tap into. The Office of Sustainable Communities, you know, here at EPA has really been key in helping us figure out sort of the people and the opportunities through the sustainability pilots, and we're hoping that some of those lessons will be really transferable to the area-wide pilots. There's potentially a lot of money at work here, which is why I think it's an important partnership to pursue. And at the same time, there's a lot of hoops that have to be jumped through to kind of get access to that money. But basically, you know, the programs that could be pulled into play, the surface transportation program, I mean, DOT provides surface transportation formula grants, you know, to states, to cities, to finance roads and highways. They can also finance congestion mitigation and transportation enhancement projects, which I think is fancy DOT terminology for doing things like, you know, bicycle and pedestrian facilities, you know, sidewalks, things like this. There's also transit construction and operation grants, which can, you know, finance, you know, system construction and maintenance. And I think what's key about this, well, I'll get to that in a second. I'm jumping ahead yet again. And also, I think what's also important is DOT puts a lot of money into what are known as MPOs, or Metropolitan Planning Organizations, and these can be, these help metro areas plan for the development and management, that should be of multi, of not or, multimodal transportation systems. So there's a lot of possibilities here. And if we just jump to the next slide, I want to reiterate, you know, the Office of Brownfields here periodically has federal partner meetings to bring together the different agencies to really talk about what everybody's doing. And at the meeting in March of 2009, DOT actually stood up and reaffirmed its brownfield policy, which is that, you know, if you're doing a transportation project, you know, if you're going to do things like, you know, putting in a road, putting in a bus barn, putting in a transit stop, you know, putting in a maintenance facility, and the site that's best suited for that activity happens to be a contaminated site or a brownfield site, well, then you can use transportation funding to clean that up as part of the transportation development process. I mean, this has important ramifications because it really means that there's a way in which these sites can be factored into transportation strategies and then in turn leads to resources that can be used for the cleanup. And I think more generally in terms of some of the area-wide planning potential, sort of the last piece of that slide, well, the DOT programs can support related revitalization in a number of ways. They can help upgrade existing facilities, which may be very key if you're trying to, you know, add a bus stop, add a rail stop, you know, things like this. As part of that, they can also offer transportation amenities that improve access or marketability of some of these sites. It may be a spur road. It may be something else like this that really opens up your area-wide planning area for reuse, and the DOT resources can help with that. And I think what we're seeing in a lot of, or in a growing number of communities, is that the transportation money can be part of the pollution solution. We're seeing more communities using roads as caps, you know, to link sites together. So there's a lot of interesting potential out there that you should think about. And if we just go to the next slide, you know, just some of these specific things that DOT resources can be used that might help in an area-wide context: traffic flow improvements, you know, bus and rail modernization, transit facilities, you know, key pedestrian and bicycle programs and facilities. If historic preservation or readapting an old rail station or something like that turns out to be an important part of your area-wide approach, you can use DOT money for some of those efforts, preservation of abandoned rail corridors, planning. Again, there's a lot, you know, of potential at transportation programs to really creatively integrate a number of projects into an area-wide revitalization effort. And we're going to have someone on from DOT in a couple of weeks. DOT has really been, I think, a really important ally in some of the sustainability pilots, and we've really, I'm going to use the word, uncovered a number of people who, a number of DOT people in the regions that have been quite interested in these linkages. And so this is something really to consider. I want to give you a couple of quick examples coming up. We get to the next slide, which should be number 36. This is an example. Emeryville, California was probably one of the first communities in the country that made a real judgment to focus its brownfield revitalization, you know, around a transportation strategy. And what they've done in Emeryville, a number of things. I mean, they built a rail station on an old tank facility. They've also, you know, spurred a lot of surrounding redevelopment using transportation resources. They've expanded their downtown as a transit-oriented development. They've worked to develop the site, several sites into a transit center, and they've done a number of things using transportation funding and roads and bridges as institutional control. The real lesson is that the transportation money can really be a focal point of your revitalization strategy if that's the kinds of things you want to do. And I just want to put this example out here because it's just so cool. And it's also a transportation example. This is in Boise, Idaho, where some highway district funds were used as part of a larger effort to basically tear down a deteriorating parking garage in downtown and set the stage for the development of what is now the largest LEED Platinum certified building between Chicago and the West Coast. The transportation money was key to this project. because of the way in which it was used for demolition and also to reconfigure the site to make it more attractive to this LEED Platinum development. And I'm going to move on from there. But I guess just to mention that the lesson out of this one is, you know, that the transportation resources can really be the core of a reuse effort that has a lot of very good, green, comprehensive benefits. And like, you know, just moving on to the next one here, in terms of the reality check, I mean, there's a number of things you need to keep in mind. I mean, the transportation, it's a lot of money. It can also be a lot of work to access it. I mean, the communities have to work through the state MPOs and the local transportation agencies, and only you know for sure how challenging that will be. The projects are determined by states and the MPOs, and they need to fit with the MPO plan. The MPO planning process can take a long time, so if you've got something you want to get underway from start to finish in a year or two, the transportation resources may be difficult to do. And again, going back to the point, you may have a lot of outreach to do. It can be difficult to get an alternative transportation-related use into the local system. I mentioned the reaffirmation of the DOT policy, and I think what's really important is that because so many revitalization strategies involve transportation infrastructure one way or the other, it can be a really key resource to think about as you're figuring out where you're going to put things in your area. And in-house here, the next program I want to mention just really quickly. Actually, are there any questions on transportation? We're going to have someone for transportation in a few weeks.
Okay. This is Drew from Ironbound Community Corporation in Newark. And I just wanted to be clear, DOT grants, they need to go through governments, or are some of these grants, can they be awarded to nonprofit organizations?
You know, I have to double check that. I believe that they can only go to governments who can then reuse them or redelegate them, but I am not 100% sure, and I will have to check that for you.
Thank you. And one quick other question related to DOT. Are there any resources out there from, say, the Federal Railway Administration? I only ask because we have an active Conrail line in our area-wide planning.
I'm going to answer that by saying there are, and we have to find out specifically what those are. I can tell you that one of the sustainability pilots, I mean, one of the people that has really gotten engaged in that pilot is from the FRA.
I
forget who that is offhand, and we can find that out, though. And was it in Indy? I'm looking because the person from the Office of Sustainable Communities is sitting right next to me, and I'm trying to plead for help. But you're right, they have their own resources. They may be more limited. But what's actually interesting is a lot of they can be really helpful in kind of helping with the linkage between some of the preservation and the rails to trails and things like that. And we can find that out for you and get that. You know what? I can make sure that I get that addressed in the DOT webinar in a few weeks.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Watching my clock tick by here. I'm just going to mention really quickly, you know, that we clearly also have some in-house resources, and we're going to have a later webinar in this series focusing really on the intra-EPA resources. And I will also tell you that here's the pitch to go to the Brownfields Conference in Philadelphia. We're going to have an intra-agency town hall meeting talking about some of the creative ways in which sort of non-Brownfield EPA resources can be kind of pulled into this. But I just want to mention that, you know, some of the states are starting to explore some creative applications of the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Loan Funds. And just briefly, you know, these are funds that EPA, they're state funds, EPA puts money into them each year. The real key is the state set the RLF priorities. Individuals and nonprofits are among eligible loan recipients, and I actually have to find out the distinction. I mean, the guidelines don't say businesses, but they say individuals, so I'm not quite sure where the fine print is on that. We can find that out. But what is important is that these, you know, RLFs can finance loans up to 20 years for activities that can include brownfield mitigation to correct or prevent water quality problems. So if you can make the water link, you may have an opportunity to tap into the state water RLF. And it can be used for all sorts of things, you know, site assessment, you know, disposing of us, excavation, dealing with contaminated sediment. So there's a number of things that can be done, and I'm being mindful of the time, so I'm going to move on. Just a quick example. Ohio has been the leading state in terms of earmarking. I mean, it might not be the right word, so I'll just say using some of its, RLF funds to meet contamination needs. And the example here, I mean, they actually loaned money to a company to do brownfield cleanup because there was concern that the contaminants were going to leach into the Cuyahoga River. And so with that cleanup done, they were able to attract a corporate office building to that site. So, again, a pretty interesting use of that. Again, some reality check here. Again, the state set the priorities and determine who's going to get the RLF proceeds. One of the things that was put into the stimulus and it was carried through to the FY10 appropriation and potentially is going to be in the FY11 as well is that states are supposed to identify green infrastructure projects for priority as they're deciding who's getting their RLF resources. So if this priority is maintained and you're in an area-wide planning area and your green infrastructure can fit, you might have a leg up on accessing some of your state RLF funds. I mean, right now, EPA's water office is developing strategies for green ice infrastructure financing. They're going to do that over the next year, and some of these might be, useful in the context of some of the area-wide planning efforts, depending on how they come out. Are there any questions? I did not put the brownfield stuff in here because I think that's the one program that people are familiar with. But clearly and obviously, OBLR has tremendous resources that can be used to inform this. And one of the things we're going to talk about when we have our EPA intra-agency a little later in the series, also the Office of Sustainable Communities has a range of technical assistance resources that might also be useful in some of these contexts depending on what you're going to do. So we're going to get to that later on in the series, but I at least wanted to get a placeholder comment in on those now. Are there any questions? Okay. In the time we have left, and I'm going to count on Gene and Amy to kind of get that hook out there. One of the things I do want to mention, again, those are the key grant programs. One of the things I also want to make sure that you're thinking about, and I'm going to go through these very quickly, and I would be happy to take questions either now or in follow-up, emails. One of the things I want you to think about is that as you're pulling together your ideas for what's going to go onto these sites, because there's a number of federal tax incentives which are likely to be around for the long term, or at least the several-year term, that might be very useful in helping you to attract private capital or attract certain kinds of uses to these sites. So I just want to get these out there so you have this information as you're thinking about your planning. I think knowing about them and possible partners might help you make some decisions as you're going forward with your area-wide planning strategies. If we can get to the next one, which will be slide 43. I think it's important as you're thinking about these strategies to remember that there are a number of advantages in using tax incentives in brownfield projects. I mean, they can increase the project's rate of return. One of the things is that they can attract sort of, I'm going to call, unconventional players to the redevelopment table. There are actually people out there that are only interested in tax advantages, and they really don't much care what they're used for, and their money is good, and it can be a really useful way of bringing in some additional players to your project. And from an, they also ease the borrower's cash flow by freeing up cash that's ordinarily needed for tax payments. If you're doing a larger project, some of these credits can be sold for cash, what's termed syndicated. This can attract additional investment. Basically, what happens is some portion of the tax value is sold up front and brings in immediate cash. Probably the most important reason, though, to think about these is that, in most of these cases, they're not subject to a competitive public grant process. The tax incentive is out there. The steps and criteria are known, and if you meet them, you get it. So that can bring an important certainty to the project planning process. I'm going to go very quickly through these, because I think we just have a little bit of time left. 10 minutes. This is going to be the tax incentive lightning round. So just pretend I've turned into Betty White. The first one is rehabilitation tax credits. This is the most commonly used federal tax incentive for brownfields. This basically allows you to take a credit for work that you do on historic structures with rehab work certified by the state. But also you need to remember, if you're just dealing with an old building that may not have gone through a historic process, a building that was built before 1936, you can also get a 10% credit. Again, something to remember. Let's move on. Just a quick, two quick examples. The next one, slide 45, the Thames Street Landing in Bristol, Rhode Island. What I want to point out to this one is this was a project that, again, it was developed. It was an area-wide type project focusing on the Bristol waterfront. The lenders and investors were interested in this only if it would work. Surprise, surprise. And what they wanted as their demonstration that it would work was positive cash flow. The historic rehab tax credits led to the positive cash flow, which in turn enticed the lenders to put money into the subsequent phases. So, again, a very important use for this incentive. The next one I have up here is just an old fire station in Northampton, Massachusetts. I have this because, you know, in looking through the area-wide applications, I mean, a lot of you are dealing with areas that may just have these old buildings. And in this case, it was a small project, just a few studios. But, again, it was the cash flow impacts that really made this project pencil out. So we're going to move on here. Low-income housing tax credits can encourage capital investment in affordable housing, you know, in any kind of a targeted site, vacant properties, brownfields, designated area, whatever. Each state gets an allocation of these credits, $1.75 per capita. Each state decides, you know, basically how it's going to allocate these credits, and these credits go to communities and nonprofits. The 2008, one of the homeowner assistance packages that Congress passed as part of, you know, this whole, I hate to use the word bailout, but I can't think of another one. We don't have much time to think of a new term. But as part of the homeowner assistance, it requires states to give green priority to allocations. I'm trying to work with HUD to figure out what this actually means in practice, but it could very well mean if you're going to put a housing project in your area and you're going to do it in a green way, you might have a leg up in this allocation process. If I can go to the next big slide, this is number 48. This is an example of a green affordable housing project done in Boston, a former fish processing plant. The low-income housing tax credits were the key part of the financing incentive. What they do is they guarantee a certain minimum return to investors in these projects, which is intended to offset the perceived risk of financing affordable housing. And in this case, as you can see in that bottom picture, very attractive housing. It was done with green energy, transit-oriented development. This is the kind of project that, again, if your area-wide strategy would include housing, just might give you a leg up in the state allocation project process. And the next one, just really quickly, is an interesting strategy. This is a rent-to-own townhouse community in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Obviously, the top picture is what you were trying to work around, but clearly a brownfield distress area. This has been redesigned to fit into the nearby downtown, again, also done in a green way. And I think what these examples show is that you can really successfully do affordable housing, you know, as part of your community reuse. I want to move on to the next one, which is energy efficiency. This is actually, to me, a very exciting strategy. There's a lot of efforts underway here at EPA to figure out some of the energy and site reuse connections. I just want to point out that the incentives you can see on this slide, these were mostly incentives that were in place, but they were expanded and extended in the stimulus. They could really fit nicely into construction strategies on brownfield sites. Again, they focus on both construction and also installing on-site solar or fuel cell or small wind or renewable systems. Those of you thinking about doing manufacturing reuse as a part of your area-wide planning, that last point it was an expanded credit for combined heat and power installation. So there's some real interesting things to think about in terms of financing that are linked to energy. If we can just go to Mike, one quick example. This is an example that used Oregon State incentives, which are very similar to the federal incentives. I couldn't find a good example of that because the federal ones are fairly new and they're just really working themselves into the market right now. This shows you how they can play out on the ground in a fairly small scale. The top picture is an abandoned gas station in Eugene. When I've used this example before, I'd like to point out that it was not only an abandoned gas station, but it was also the site of some non-Pfizer pharmaceutical activity that was clearly a blight on the community. And in this case, I mean, Oregon State Energy Tax Credits, very similar to the Fed credits, led to the conversion of this site into a biodiesel fueling station. Again, a very interesting reuse. It fit within the community sort of, you know, construct. And it was a very interesting way to do green construction and also expand fuel options in this area, something interesting to think about. The next one I want to mention is New Markets Tax Credits. This is a complicated incentive, and I would be happy to follow up with anybody. We clearly don't, I mean, even if we had more than 10 minutes, this would be hard to do in one sitting. But what I want to make you aware of is that the federal government through the Treasury Department has this extensive program in place where they basically, the whole idea of this program is to attract federal investment in low-income areas, which again fit really well with a lot of our area-wide pilot community criteria. And basically, the federal investors get these 39% tax credits and for money that they put into what are known as CDEs or community development entities. And these CDEs, in turn, use these allocations to make loans or investments in the activities you can see up on the screen. They need to do these reinvestment. As you can see, there has been a lot of money put out. $5 billion awarded to 99 allocatees in October of 2009. These winning allocatees targeted 49 states for investment. So if you're not in Wyoming, you've got access to some of this allocation somehow potentially. There's also been a lot awarded previously. There's probably close to $15 billion in allocations which have yet to be made. So there's resources out there. Now, just I have to take a second on the next slide to focus on the fine print on this. It can be very challenging to become a CDE. It is not for the faint of heart. It's time-consuming and it's costly. So from a brownfield perspective, and I think from an area-wide perspective, you really want to, I take what I call the matchmaking approach. You want to find a CDE that has an allocation because they have got to allocate their credits within 5 years. Many of them are bumping up against that timeline, and they're going to be looking for projects. We can get you the website, but if you want to even go ahead and look, the Treasury through the, if you just Google CDFI, for community development financial institutions and New Markets Tax Credits, you will be able to go through a couple of clicks, and Treasury is really good about posting who gets an allocation and how much they have and their target state area. There's a lot out there that this can work. I think what's important for this last round, 98% of the $5 billion is going to be targeted for nonprofit and for-profit real estate and business development. So what this means is that there is going to be significant capital investment potentially made in central city areas. So this is something we'll follow up with you, but again, it's something to think about. Find those CDEs and go talk to them as you start getting together your ideas about what you want to do. And just my one quick example of how this can work, this is the Bethel Center in Chicago. Bethel New Life is a faith-based CDC. They used New Markets Tax Credits that came through Bank One and State Farm Insurance to basically take an old brownfield warehouse site right near an L station in Chicago and convert it into 6 storefront businesses. So again, a real interesting reuse here. And finally, I just want to mention, I know we're running out of time, way out of time.
Jean, would it be okay if we had like 5 more minutes?
I can let you guys go 5 minutes over the scheduled end time, although I must warn you that some of your participants may not be able to stay on that long.
Right.
Go ahead. Thank you.
All right. Well, this will be another one. I'm sorry, I should have scoped out this timing better. But the Brownfield Cleanup Cost Expensing Incentive is back. We've talked about this, you know, at conferences and over the past while. This has kind of, it's been in place, it's expired. the Tax Act that the president signed just around Christmas time extended it to the end of this year, and it made it retroactive to the 1st of January of 2009. And what I want to do is, I think we're just going to skip through the next couple so I have time to get to the end. But just basically, it allows private site owners, and it is targeted to private site owners, to deduct their cleanup costs in the year they incur them rather than having to capitalize them over time. And these costs can include pretty much anything that you need to spend to do a brownfield project. Site assessment, cleanup, your state fees, removal. This has gotten very little use. It really is something worth exploring. Let me just go on to the example here. You can see in this case,
slide 58.
It's been, in this case, used in Westchester, Pennsylvania to clean up a former pharmaceutical dump site. The developer here said that this saved them nearly $800,000 in taxes because it was such a heavy cleanup. And if you go to even to the next slide, number 59, very small-scale example out of Indiana, pretty routine cleanup. But again, for a small project, $80,000 in tax relief can be a critical tipping factor. I just want to go on to the next slide. This incentive does have its challenges. A lot of developers don't understand it. A lot of people don't know it exists. Treasury has not put out a lot of rules on it. That means there's a lot of vagueness. And for a lot of accountants and attorneys, vagueness is a no-no. So it can be very challenging to deal with, but it can be very useful in some cases. And just to kind of wrap up, I wanted to make sure we had a chance to get to this. OBLR and a whole bunch of us are putting together this series of webinars that is going to focus in. What our goal today was to give you a flavor for the programs that are out there, to get you to start thinking about what might fit with what you want to do in your area-wide planning strategy. And what we want to do over the next couple of months is have a series of webinars with the agencies to really dig into some of the specifics of their programs, you know, what they can do, how they can work, how you can pull them into your brownfield strategy. And we're planning on doing the HUD CDBG one on March 23rd. I think that's final. That's close to being finalized.
Yeah, this is Amy Storm. With all of the dates on here, we wanted to give you an idea of what we were thinking, 2 in March, 1 in April, 2 in May. But you'll be getting information from me or through the person at EPA that you've been working with on your project, like you did for this one, as the times and dates come together and
right.
Things get firmed up. So for your tentative planning purposes, this is what we provided today.
Right. And as that last point, I mean, if needs for other ones come up, we'll try to get those scheduled as well. We really want to facilitate as much information flow as possible. And if you go to slide 63, one of the things I did want to do is point out a couple of resources that might get you thinking about, where you can kind of take a look at these to think about what you might want to get out of these next set of webinars. The EPA Brownfield Office has put out a federal programs guide. It's put out several editions. The one that's on their website now is a 2009 edition. It goes through a whole host of federal programs, talks about brownfield connections, talks about the tax incentives, and there's going to be a brand new edition at Philadelphia, so you can get it literally hot off the CD press. The other publication resource I want to mention is one called Leveraging the Partnership DOT HUD and EPA Programs for Sustainable Communities. This is being done in conjunction with DOT and HUD and the Office of Sustainable Communities here at EPA. It's really an effort to kind of give you a sort of a capsule of more than two dozen of the different transportation and housing programs and environmental programs that can be targeted to a range of projects. It gives you a brief description of those, and it gives you some web links if you want to explore them in more depth. So these are two resources that can really, that might help inform your thinking as you're going forward, so you can kind of get those tough questions ready for HUD and DOT. We're not even going to tell them you're going to ask tough questions. We want to get them here first. So we'll want to do that. And just if you look at the very last slide, number 63, if as you're thinking about what we've talked about today, or you're looking at the resources, or you have additional questions, please feel free to follow up with any of us on that. Our goal is to give you the tools you need to really creatively and also practically and realistically think about what you can do, in your area-wide areas. And so anything we can provide to you to help you inform and advance that decision-making, just let us know. And I think with that, I know we had to rush through the tax incentives. I guess it's up to Jean. If we have time for any questions, we would be happy to take anything by email later as well.
Okay. If you're on the line, and I don't see any more electronic questions that have been typed up, if you want to take the next 10 seconds to type one up, go ahead. Those of you on the phone lines, I'll allow one more question to be submitted by phone. So if you're on phone, you can certainly take yourself off of mute. You may have to hit #6 to unmute your line, and feel free to ask your question. Okay, I don't see any other electronic questions coming in. So with that, I'm going to ask everybody to move on to slide number 64 and make sure that Amy and Charlie, you've made your closing statements. You have no other final reminders you'd like to make before I close things out?
This is Amy. I just want to thank Charlie very much for the excellent job, lots of good information, and we'll be looking forward to seeing how we can present more of this information going forward. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks.
Okay, excellent. So with that, I'll direct everybody to move on again to the final slide, which is slide number 64. On slide 64, you'll find the two links that I referenced earlier in today's session. The first one is the additional resources page, where you can actually download a copy of today's PowerPoint presentation. So if you're just working off a print copy and you'd like to have accessible hyperlinks, you can certainly go to the resources page and download it as either PDF or PowerPoint. The other option or other link that's important is the seminar feedback form. We do ask you to take a minute or two just to fill out the feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you are participating and looking for credit today, you may want to get a confirmation message once you fill out the feedback form to be sent to you so that actually verifies that you were here and gave us feedback after the session. There's a small box you can check on the feedback form, and it will send a confirmation email to you. If you're sharing the line with multiple participants, after each person submits feedback, there will be a link to let another person fill out that form so you can each take a turn. And please know that those hyperlinks, both the links and additional resources page, as well as the feedback form link, are available on the seminar homepage. You'll find them at the very bottom of the page, as well as buttons that appear on the left side. So if you're not in front of the computer right now or don't have the time, you can certainly come back and do this tomorrow if you like. So with that, I'm going to formally close out today's session. Again, I want to thank the Office of Brownfield Land Revitalization for sponsoring today's session. I want to thank all of our participants for making time in their busy schedules to join us today. And remember, there will be a number of other seminar series that will be advertised as part of this event. So you want to, I think, Amy, you guys are emailing everyone to let them know about them?
Right, exactly. We'll be emailing out the new information on each webinar as it comes together.
Okay, excellent. So if you thought this was useful, be sure to scan your inbox for an email about this, and hopefully you'll be able to sign on and join us for the future ones in the series. So with that, thank you all for joining us. I hope you have a great rest of the afternoon.
Thank you, Jean.